I have to tell you a little bit about my philosophy of groups like this. In school, I belong to a community of practice, and we get together and we do a lot of discussion, and the facilitator provides us frameworks and things like that. And so I'm hoping that today you guys are going to provide the color. I'm kind of providing the framework, so I'm really going to depend on your ideas and thoughts. And I have to tell you a little bit about myself before we start. I've never actually discussed this topic with a group of people in a Lutheran setting or in a religious setting. My work is mainly with Oregon Sea Grant, and I've worked with community leaders who are either elected or community heads of different offices. And then the bigger project that I'm working on, just a little background, is with seven different coastal states on climate change issues and their case studies, and we're looking at how the community is dealing with what the risk is, whether or not they're planning for it. And so I want to talk a little bit today about resilience. Before we get started, though, I'd like to read to you a little bit from Exodus. I was trying to think of good stories that would fit kind of this topic. And this is from the very beginning of Exodus. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. Now, a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look at the Israelite people. They are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him, but if it is a girl, she shall live." But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and allowed the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, and he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every boy that is born to the Hebrews, you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live." I'll stop there. And we're thinking a little bit about resilience. This story, as you know, how it continues. There are lots of examples of a resilient community. And as I read about the Israelites in this part of the first story, it's a community of strength. And we're going to talk a little bit about communities and resilient communities. To begin with, I was going to make you write. Teacher writing intensive course. I will not make you write today. But I want you just to think for a minute, and if you feel more comfortable talking to your neighbor or something like that, just think about, what is resilience to you? What does that term mean to you?
Bouncing back.
Yeah, enduring hardships.
Ability to adapt.
Ability to adapt. How many of you have dealt or heard the term resilience as it's applied to communities? It's kind of a buzzword right now. How many of you have heard the term sustainability?
Yes.
Okay. So this is a new buzzword, by the way, after sustainability. Okay. And so you've pretty much nailed the term resilience to bounce back and how we apply it. We're going to take it one more. We're going to look a little bit more closely at it and talk about what we do, the work that I do with communities and having them become more resilient. So now I want you to think a little bit about your own personal home community. It can either be a county level or city level, or if you prefer to think about the state that you live in. I'm curious what the number one thing is in your community that challenges the resilience or the ability of your community to bounce back.
Jobs.
So where are you, do you mind, where are you from?
Whistler, Minnesota.
Okay, and so people aren't able to find work.
Yeah, it's a problem. I think it's nationwide, though.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is a little facetious, but also from Minnesota, potholes. It's not the number one, but it's kind of symbolic, endemic, and, you know.
Are you from the city?
Yeah.
That's why.
We don't have enough money in the budget to fix the things, and so the cars keep getting ruined in the big old potholes from the freezing and thawing.
Yeah. So it's more like an infrastructure kind of thing, roads and, yeah.
Basically, money.
Money. Okay.
We're from Tacoma, Washington, and we're not Seattle.
Okay. Okay. Do you want to explain a little?
Well, it's one of those other city stories, you know, that Seattle is the glamour and the wonderfulness and the big money, and Tacoma isn't.
Yeah, so it's a different kind of problem.
Psychological.
Yeah, okay, psychological. If you...
I think our community and a lot of other communities are concerned about youth.
Okay. Specifically...
Well, drugs, youth not finding their way, increasing numbers of homeless youth, stuff like that that didn't exist so much 20 years ago, maybe.
I guess you could say schools. That's, again, is the money problem. Every place I know that schools are quality, I don't say quality is shrinking, but the classes are growing, sizes are growing, programs are being cut. In our district, that's for sure.
Where are you from?
We're from Southern California.
Okay. Anybody else?
I've got one.
Oh, yeah.
As somebody who always speaks up for natural resources, the place where I grew up in Texas is experiencing a drought right now.
Okay.
I know that's been fairly common in other places, especially throughout the South and Southeast over the last decade or so. But it impacts, you know, like growth of communities, development, you know, I think, like, it impacts the communities in ways that people don't really consider it a lot of, in the same way that the other ones are managing it.
Yeah. And I deal with issues of climate and environment, so I'm always thinking about things like drought or fire or coastal communities in Oregon, winter wave heights or changing chemistry of the ocean, that kind of thing. So you guys have talked, I've heard a few examples of capital. We're talking about like actual financial capital, but I also heard people mention social capital, human capital, those sorts of things. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in one of the frameworks I'm going to show you. And so... these are all things challenging the community. I wanted to say I wasn't exactly sure what to expect or who I would be talking to today, so I'm going to tell you my assumptions about you before we start if I'm incorrect and you would like to walk out. But I see you guys. I talked to a group of Rotary Club members in Newport, Oregon, and I see the folks at Oregon as people who are generally informed and who are the type of people I would expect to see on an advisory committee or some sort of bridging type organization that might connect with the university where I work or who are trying to make a difference in the community. So that's kind of what I've prepared to talk to you as people who might be taking this information home to their communities and thinking about how you can make changes in your communities. Okay. So, I used to be an English teacher, and I do live in Oregon, but I did live in Minnesota for a very long time. A lot of you are Minnesotans. And I hope this doesn't happen, but one of my students, I asked her to give me feedback once. And this is what she wrote, and she signed her name. I recreated this, but this really did happen. All you do is stand out there and go, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to try not to do this today.
We've already noticed that.
Yeah. There's the accordion. So the organization that I work with is Extension. Do you all have experience with Extension in your community at all? Okay. And we're really, the focus right now is not only building resilient communities, but also this topic of engagement. So I'm going to try to not lecture today, and you're going to have to help me with that. All right, so we're going to look at one framework, and I don't have enough copies for everybody, so I'm sure coming. I think I have 20. So if we run out, just share with your neighbor. And I want you to just look at this front side, first of all. And as you look at the graphic, I just want you to think about what stands out to you. I'm going to be asking you kind of what stands out to you, or what are you focused on when you see it?
Can you tell us some of the words? It's kind of hard
yeah.
to hear the ones in the dark.
Okay.
To see the ones in the dark.
So, I'll give you a little lowdown here. But so this is a theory, a framework theory, and it's kind of panarchy is a created theory that talks about how change happens. Okay, and I kind of want you to think about the Exodus story, perhaps, if you identify with that, or about your own community, or about any system or group, or even at a personal level. Think about how change happens in your life. This framework is not linear, first of all. And the people who created this framework talk about creative destruction. Okay, so before I break it down a little bit, what are some of the things that you're noticing? Panarchy is just the name for like this adaptive cycle to be linked to others. So there are a number of adaptive cycles happening here.
What is the bottom one on the right-hand side? I can't quite
see. This strong?
Above that. In the dark. In the dark is where it's hard.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, release.
Release.
Yeah, so you have a scale here from weak to strong, so that's connectedness. And you have a scale on this side from little to lots, and that's capital. And we were talking about capital before, financial, human, social capital. Okay, and so it's talking about a cycle that happens where the features of the system are connectedness and capital. If you think about the Exodus story, can you think about times when connectedness was strong? Or in your own community where connectedness was strong? Mrs. Beek, yes?
I'm thinking when they went through the Red Sea.
Okay.
That's pretty strong connectedness.
Yeah.
Cooperative efforts and a single task in which the community was focused
and
committed.
Right. And they moved together, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, they're connected. Can you think of a time when the opposite was true, when there wasn't as much connectedness?
Well, later on during the Exodus, they kind of revolted against Moses in the wilderness.
Yeah, right. The whole wilderness, the frustration, the difficulty. Okay. And as far as capital goes, it's a little bit, maybe it's a little bit harder to apply to the Exodus story. But yeah, I just think of capital as resources. And resources can be more than just financial resources. I have talked to the folks from Haiti and how sometimes capital, financial capital isn't the only thing that determines the strength of a community or the ability of a community to bounce back.
Wasn't it just that they had so many people? That was mentioned 2 or 3 times in the story that you read.
Okay.
Lots of Israelites.
There's so many of them. Kind of, I hate to make the comparison, but it reminds me of invasive species. I don't want to say that, but when I read it, I'm like, this sounds like Himalayan blackberry in my backyard. Like, they're super strong. They have their babies before the midwives can get there. You know, these, on a very individual level, these are resilient people, and on a collective level, these are resilient people.
Well, that's what they were. It was an invasive species to the Egyptians.
To the Egyptians, right. Exactly, to the Egyptians. Yeah. And that's the other thing about resilience, and I'm not saying in the case of the Exodus story, but sometimes resilience of a system isn't always desirable, like with an invasive species, for example, when we're talking about natural resources. You may not want something to be resilient. You might want it to be managed in a different way. Okay. And so then panarchy, so the folks who created this, when they're talking about, I deal with management of resources, they talk about just creative destruction. A lot of systems can be linked, and that's a lot of the management of natural resources right now. One of the other big words is integrated management. Have you heard of this term at all? Integrated management. In Oregon, they're doing a statewide water plan where they're looking at how is water managed in the state of Oregon. I just worked briefly with the state agencies who are looking at how much redundancy there is and how water is managed. And it's not integrated. So this talks about integrating systems and looking at how systems might be integrated. What do you guys think about this model? Is it kind of obscure, difficult? Yeah, kind of the connection between
us.
Okay.
It seems like capital and connectedness are hard to relate to each other, for me.
Okay, yeah.
In other words, maybe I'm just thinking of financial capital, mm-hmm. whereas it should be more social capital or,
yeah.
you know, human capital or something like that.
People have a hard time when we use the term human capital because they think of, like, slaves or, you know, like, that kind of thing. But I don't know who's talking about young people in their community or, you know, a lot of rural towns have a problem with keeping young, educated people. That's human capital. That's who's sticking around in the community and kind of being the leadership. So let's look at a different model, which I think is a little bit more clear. Oh, yeah, my explanation for this one. So if you flip that page over, you know, it's another model, and this one has a lot more detail on it. And what I'd like to ask each person to do is to look on this model and decide, where do you fit in this? And you notice you kind of have two different levels. And this is a system that... it's on the... Do you guys want?
Yeah.
Okay.
What are... Just say more about the levels. I mean, one level's in the box and the other's above it?
Yeah. So, resilience... So the type of resilience that I'm dealing with is socio-ecological resilience. So then, if you take it one step further and you talk about the community and then how the community is affected by things like climate change or the environment or things like that... this is the system, and so at the top, it's kind of hierarchical. At the top, you have... Is this really a complicated model, by the way? Okay. All right. I'm stuck with you. Okay. So you have ecological properties and social properties around the globe. Maybe instead of defining everything, what do you think about this? I'm going to break it down a little bit. Just look at this bottom part and think within these... four areas where either your job or your leadership position or your interests lie as far as that model goes.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
When you start talking about how the water plan, things like this, are you making, does the state make the assumption of continually exponential population growth?
In Oregon, they do, yeah.
Why?
I'm not sure about other states. Those are the projections. That it's just going to boom.
We're from Southern California, 15 million people in the LA area. And all they talk about is how we're going to get increased population density, how we're going to handle this. And the assumption is that we're going to grow.
Right.
And I think it's a fallacy to do this.
Yeah. Why do you think that?
Why do I think that?
Yeah,
I think the Earth is a finite resource, a finite size planet, and we're just destroying it by overpopulation.
So are you advocating from a policy level then preparing for something like scarcity?
What?
Instead of growth?
That's the way of doing it, but eventually, in fact, in this country, I think it was Nixon, had a population study for this country. It's the last time the government has ever talked about possibly even that we're getting too big, we consume too much. And right now, they still say, well, you've got plenty of land out there, which is a stupid thing to say. mean, you know, you drive through the forest. Well, but those are what you're, what's helping you live the way you want to live. And you, you have all these infrastructure, you have plants and factories and so on. You know, one extremely simplistic view I've seen written up. Oh, you put the whole world population of the state of Texas on a city-sized lot, and plenty of them. Yeah.
National Geographic has a great article on population. Yes. They say everybody could fit in this, you know, but if we were all standing shoulder to shoulder. And the question isn't so much where we can fit, but, and this is, resilience, again, has to do with quality of life.
Quality of life and the footprint that you exert, your environmental footprint.
I mean, how happy we'll be at the size that we're going to be at. And I know I don't want to get too much into water, and I hope that you go to, is it Renita's workshop on water? She's going to show some, do some really cool stuff with water. But, and I know Southern California water is a huge deal. And as far as being a resilient community, water is something that you really have to think about.
Well, you're talking about things like desalination now, say, which is very expensive, very environmentally bad thing to do. It takes a lot of energy. You use reverse osmosis to purify the seawater. But so that's going to make these costs go up for that, so for water. I think it's like about $1,000 an acre foot now, is what they're talking about. And that's, the little town has, that does have a aquifer under it, and it costs about $250 an acre foot. Pump it out of the ground. In fact, down there we have seawater barriers now around the aquifer.
Yeah.
Keep out the seawater.
Keep out the seawater.
And that pumps 1 million gallons a day right through the ground, fresh water to keep out the seawater.
Yeah.
I'd like to say crazy.
I'd like to bring a note of optimism to this because we all need it. Because I would think we all agree that we don't need any more growth, population growth, but how in heaven's name do we make that clear? But you know, education and making people aware of what and social responsibility, and I use tobacco smoking as my hope. I mean, how long ago was it? Of course I smoke in the back of the airplane. I mean, that's where everybody smokes. And of course my brother, the executive, is going to smoke in his office. No, he's not. He's going to smoke outside and he quit smoking. I mean, so there is social pressure and common sense will prevail if we can get the leadership to start addressing it verbally.
So in what you've addressed in on the last slide, you've talked a little bit about you're remembering a former situation where somehow we've made a change, and can we apply that to other problems in the community? And there are institutional responses. How many of you live in a community that's very polarized where people can't really agree on what the government should do or who should pay for it? Do you have that problem in your community at all?
Okay. On the federal scale, we're seeing more
on the
polarity of the two major parties.
Right.
The further apart, the closer together.
And so that is also a problem. I mean, that's one thing that affects the resilience of communities. And so this model actually has a little bit more detail, and it talks a little bit more about not only financial capital, but also things like the environment, unlike trade, soil resources, wealth and infrastructure, community income. These are all things that you mentioned at the beginning down here. And then it also talks about over time you have long-term problems and you have short-term problems. You have catastrophic problems and you have chronic problems. And you also have long-term planning and short-term planning. So there's a huge level of detail that somebody needs to be responsible for in the community to help figure out how is our community going to be resilient. How many thumbs up, thumbs down are you pretty optimistic about the community that you live in, say local level, that this a strong and thriving community? Okay.
Well, our little town, we live in suburb of Orange County here, suburb of the metropolitan area, is just about built out. I mean, all the land is used for housing. And so it's a good government, and they're accepting this, although they're still trying to create more businesses to pay taxes.
Mm-hmm. Anybody who's pessimistic? Yeah.
I guess I was thinking. We have a globe up there.
Yeah, right.
I think about our globe.
Mm-hmm.
And that the nature of those like maybe strips that you had on that first plan, and even this one, the complexity, the different dimensions, and how they, there's this call, you have human actors.
Yes.
And I sometimes, there's such stress in terms of the human part of it, not to mention the environmental, the avalanches and the hurricanes and eruptions of volcanoes. I'm very guilty of being sometimes a little less positive.
Yeah, and that doesn't make you less concerned necessarily.
Oh, no.
But there's a point at which there's kind of saturation of what can be done. How many of you are focused at the global level?
Some issues, yeah.
What is that?
Some issues at the global level. I mean, population at the global level is a very significant significant issue, and the rate at which we're using resources at the global level is huge. And we have the inability to maximize the human capital of the planet. Very large swaths of our population. Those are all huge, huge issues.
I have a question for you. I know that you are a biologist. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Do you think humans, is it true about the lemmings that they self-regulate, like they jump off the side of the cliff?
And yeah, that's true. I mean,
well, you're suggesting.
I'm sorry. No, I'm not saying. I'm just asking.
It's not very well understood what the triggering is for the cycle, but it's clear that when the population density gets beyond the food supply, they go into migrating patterns that turn them up over the cliff.
Yeah, and as human populations, and then also the faith community thinking about population and what do we say as Christians about population and about people's,
Vatican had a scientific committee a few years ago. They invited a lot of the top scientists in the world to discuss the population issue. And these are names you'd recognize right away. This is a few years ago. And he gave a report to the Pope, and he thanked them all for their inputs like that, and said, but that's the wrong answer.
Yeah.
They recommended population stabilization and a gradual reduction. People become more wealthy, they tend to consume more. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like we see the oil industry in China now and stuff like that. But now the Chinese want the same things that we want, and the Indians in India. They all want cars. They see us having things, that's a good life. I want that good life. That's the reason for immigration, is that they want to come here and live like we do. And I don't think the earth can stand it.
Yeah.
I mean, like right now, I think we have 5% of the world's population needs a fourth of the resources. The whole world lived like it, and I think it's about six times as much you figure it out. Six times the resources, six times the oil we burned in the days, and six times the iron or the copper or whatever, and some of these rare earth metals that we use for all our little gadgets like computers and iPods and iPhones and so on.
It's overwhelming, yeah.
That the government doesn't want to address the issue.
Right, and so we're talking about all things that affect the resilience of a community, and then the question is, and the big question that I always come to is, how do we put this all into some sort of, how do we find a way through or a way around, or, you know, how do we deal with this? How do we deal with this? It's the big question, and just to bring it back to the idea of community resilience, I think the folks who are working on frameworks for analyzing almost like best practices, or, you know, how can you create a better community and community resilience for your own community, are trying to put all those factors into one model, and to think about if we are concerned citizens, if we care about our community, and not only our community, but communities across the globe where it's not fair. You know, we're externalizing our pollution. You know, we do work here, and people, you know, garbage goes somewhere else, that kind of thing. How do we, as people who care about that, do anything in the world? It seems so big and so difficult. How do we do this? And so hopefully this week you've kind of touched on all the little parts that I'm going to be talking about later this week. This framework starts to address it, but I think it's a big, still a big question. Yeah.
Does resilience mean surviving what is going to happen anyway, or does it mean doing something about it so that it won't happen?
I'm so glad that you asked, because I have a little glossary that I'll give you if you ever want to refer to this later. We'll return to an example. Oh, this will work. This is Katrina, and this is really small. And again, I only made 10 copies of this one, so you will have to share. But this is kind of another model that talks about, does transformation happen in the community? Yeah, you'll have to share. Is it intended? Does the problem persist? And again, depends on management and resources. And I realize that might be overwhelming you with models and terms and things like that. This is the kind of stuff that's being applied to problems, at least in the work that I do.
Is it possible to make that one any bigger?
I think maybe I can. Let's see. Oops. Is that better?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness, that's huge. All right. I've got a Mac, which is... Okay, so you guys can see that. I actually really like this model because it shows me where I can make a difference or where an intervention can occur. Lots of arrows, though, isn't it? Yeah.
I'm just curious if this is on there, because one of the things that I think is most interesting in our community is the connectedness internationally.
Oh, okay.
And we have like 5 sister cities around the globe. And one of them is the greenest city in Europe.
Oh, okay.
And so we have this interaction going back and forth. It's Vex Show Sweden. And so we have this interaction going back and forth of people trying to learn from what they do, and then they come and do it.
And it's an exchange. There's actually a name for that. It's called innovation diffusion in political theory.
Innovation diffusion.
Yeah, and so how many of you live in communities where you're kind of an early adopter of change in your community? I know in Corvallis, where I live, it feels like there are a lot of people who are progressive and adopting, which isn't always the best thing. But that definitely is a strength of a community, is having connections outside. So boosting resilience can be, yeah.
And it is connected with inspiration, which is another part of resilience.
Yeah.
I think having, you know, encouragement and models to try. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So I really like this down at the bottom. The vulnerability, adaptability, resilience, and transformability. Has anybody ever seen an assessment, like a vulnerability assessment? Holden had one, something done here with the mines. The EPA and the folks came in to look at, you know, what was happening to the water here, and they assessed what's the vulnerability. Who's vulnerable here? Who are the receptors? Are they the people, fish, downstream, what, you know, plants, that sort of thing? And then what an organization like the Forest Service or EPA will do is go through and look at what's driving the problem. What are the pathways, you know, that you can maybe step in? And then who are the receptors? And are those receptors essential, you know, or high priority as far as investing in remediating or somehow fixing my problem? And so vulnerability assessment is a lot of what I think about. I did one on CAFOs. Are you familiar with the feed operations and the runoff getting into the water? And we worked on one in Lincoln County, and it was affecting the oyster industry. And so this is something that you'll see a lot with agencies. So, and again, this is at the community level. This can also happen in a human system or in a school system or something like that. You're dealing with these concepts in the health of the system. How many of you felt like Hurricane Katrina was dealt with in a competent way? Hurricane Katrina, or incompetent or competently?
Oh.
But well.
Depends on which place. I worked Mississippi, and I think they responded much better than New Orleans did.
Okay.
That was the impression I got down there.
Why do you believe that?
Because the governor sent people down immediately down there, and they got down there in a really timely fashion. Started out early, whereas New Orleans, the governor there was dragging their heels.
Okay.
That's what I heard down there.
So it's a leadership then?
Yep.
Yeah, this is just an interesting breakdown of what happened with Hurricane Katrina.
See, the capital, you haven't mentioned the one thing that was probably the worst thing about the Katrina, uh-huh. is that you're trying to rebuild now underwater.
Yeah.
I mean, that is idiotic.
Yeah.
There's enough land in this country you can put all your housing above water at flood levels. But they're going to rebuild them where they are, which is below sea level.
And again, should the government step, I mean, should there be some sort of regulation that prevents that?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. And you can do this, you know, you got to have those pumps running 24/7, mm-hmm. keep the water out.
Yeah.
So we're going to be lost.
We throw up our hands and we say, what do we do about it? What do we do about it? Yeah.
The towns and the low-lying areas on rivers like Mississippi and something like that. Yeah, it's good farmland because it, all the silt keeps periodically replenishes the land. It's about fire.
Right.
Are they resilient for rebuilding on low sea level?
That's a question. I talked to one guy in one of the communities I dealt with, and he's a county commissioner, and I was asking him about climate change, and he said to me, that's evolution. If they want to build there, they are weak, and they can just be destroyed. And I was like, really? You believe that? Or you think that? And there are people who, later this week, we're going to talk a little bit about values and different, you know, political values, that sort of thing. But I don't know, as we're building there, we have the technology, right? But we're limited somehow with the expense.
Well, that goes back to my question.
Yeah.
Aren't they being resilient to deal with inevitably what's going to happen? I mean, it's going to happen.
Right.
They're not doing anything to change the fact that it's going to happen. It'd be like saying to Southern California, why are you living there? It's a desert. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no water. So how do you tell people in New Orleans to move and not tell people in Southern California to move?
Yeah.
Or in Arizona or lots of places. Mm-hmm. I mean, the earth is not so nice in lots of places, and yet we live there. So is resilience learning to live in places where bad things are going to happen? Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Or
and
is,
that,
is
right,
it doing something
goes,
to change?
Right, and that goes back to the first slide that I gave you, which is what I think, this actually really speaks to me as far as, I don't think it's a whether or not we should or should not, you know, live in a certain place. It's the fact that there are always going to be struggles and difficulties in the community, and then how do we deal with them, and then what's the limitation or how far do we go? At some point you run out of resources or something. So again, memory. Well, repeat what you just said. Just small.
Well, I'm still trying to understand what resilience should mean as we're thinking about it and talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Should it mean that we should do things in the face of inevitability? I mean, things are going to happen that are bad, and do we become resilient by knowing how to deal with those when they happen or after they happen? Or should we do something different to change what shouldn't happen? We don't want to have, like move.
Move, or to regulate, or to have the government regulate. And I think those are the decisions that people are making all the time in their communities, and they're constantly trying to figure out. I mean, I think historically, communities have used things like story, for example, or now we use science to explain, here's what's happening, how do we make a good decision about this, should we move forward? And later on this week we'll talk a little bit about Eleanor Ostrom, who, I don't know if you're familiar, she won the Nobel Prize in Economics. For her discussion, there's not just one solution. We're going to have to constantly be coming up with new solutions and constantly be coming up with new ways to deal with environmental problems. Dealing with climate change is what I think a lot about, but all the other problems that we mentioned. And so it's not just a one-time event. And I really like the story of Exodus and those lasting stories that are metaphors for how does a community deal with change, whether it be environmental or any other kind of change. There are things that are lasting and true that we can use to enlighten. And you mentioned one with connecting with other communities or really valuing the expertise of others and being open and sharing. There are many other things we can do to be resilient as communities.
Well, could we, like his question, could you say a little bit about where you stand?
Where do I stand?
In other words, is the resilience that you are holding up as an ideal a resilience that shows some wisdom? Or is it primarily enthusiasm? I mean, that's an oversimplification of what he said.
But when you say enthusiasm, what do you mean?
Well, like something bad happens to you and you bounce back. Okay, the people in New Orleans have bounced back and they've now built houses in the floodplain again.
Yeah.
Is that a good example? Is that what you're talking about as
no,
a model
not
of resilience?
Or
is
no,
that
right.
a model of...
That's a model of... that's a model of... here, on this unintended
word.
Transformation that... Or just repeating the same mistake, which is persistence.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if you're working with the communities on the coast of Oregon, right? And what are you... What's the suggestion to them in terms of that term, resilience?
Right. And we're dealing with tsunami hazard and,
right.
you know, the beach, the house is just falling off the edge, entire winter... wave heights, and it's hard to convince people that it's not such a good idea
to what?
To build there anymore, even though the science says you shouldn't build there. People still want to build, even though you have regulation. So, yes, of course, it's not a good idea to rebuild in a place where you're going to be destroyed. And is that kind of what you're asking, is my opinion on that?
Yeah, well, again, it's just for clarity, I'd like to understand what your definition of resilience would be. How would it be broader than just bounce back?
Yeah, and there's a whole... I have one more hand up for you. And this is... There's a whole history of the topic of resilience between... And it's gone back and forth between engineering and ecological. So these are kind of... Since 1981, this term has been looked at. And I also have copies of this too. So do I personally have my own definition of it? I think I do borrow from these guys.
What if you look like a tornado where it's a haphazard type thing?
Like one catastrophic, one-time event?
So, I mean, you're not in a bad spot and it just happened. You know, and that would be an example of resiliency where a city comes back.
Yeah, I mean, a community has to decide how much money they want to invest in planning for a catastrophic event. What's the probability of that event happening, and what's the magnitude? How much is this going to affect? And I guess risk is always there, and it's a question of what's a priority. And so it's a complicated thing for humans to decide. Is planning for tornadoes our priority? How much money are we going to invest in this? How much of our resources are we going to put into
this? And of course, the theory is that it's not going to happen to you twice, supposedly.
Yeah, right. And maybe your manager is doing a vulnerability assessment telling you, because they do probability and they say, is this a priority? Is it not? I know in Oregon they have this new climate change checklist of what's a priority and what's not important in planning. And there's always a risk that any of those things could happen to a community, and it's just a matter of how much resources people have to invest in it and how much they want to. Yeah.
The one thing that hadn't mentioned yet is the reason people do dumb things is because the government will back them up. like the Outer Banks, the Outer Barrier Islands out on the East Coast along the Atlantic Ocean there, those are there for a reason. Well, God did it or whatever, but those are very vulnerable all the time. But the beautiful places to locate your house and then watch the ocean and stuff like that, and there are a lot of million-dollar houses out there. Storm comes up, they get knocked down, they borrow money, or the government declares a disaster area and give them these extremely low-rate loans or even give them cash to rebuild.
So it's using public resources.
Yeah, so it's public resources that make people do dumb things.
But that's politics.
Well, that's the problem.
That's what it is. It's not an issue of probability, it's an issue of politics.
Well, zoning commissions can take care of that, I would think.
No, but that's still politics. You still have people that say, I want to build where I want to build, and I'll do what I will do. You'll provide for me if I guess wrong.
Yeah.
We have that all over.
Last week we had a real immersion here in Haiti.
Uh-huh.
It was a real intense week. I've been coming here for 26 years, and I'm not sure I've ever seen a week where we had that intensive experience, including Haitians here, and including parents of somebody who lost a child there.
Right.
And stuff. You know, they had a mess before the earthquake in that country. And they had an earthquake. I mean, we talk about losing 3,000 some people in 9/11 and people in Katrina. They lost 230,000 people in 35 seconds.
Yeah.
That's half as many American soldiers as were killed in World War II. And they lost a good part of their buildings. They had interchange of sewage and water, they had cholera, all kinds of stuff. But you talk about the need for resiliency. But what's remarkable is when you talk to the Haitians, you hear them. They've got all this hope,
yeah.
And they made it real clear to us last week that a lot of money has been spent in Haiti. It's been kind of a financial sinkhole for a long time. But they just talk about if you want to have resiliency, if you want to have hope and improve things, you got to have relationships. That people have tried to help us without having relationships with us. And I think that, I just think that in terms of our community, one of the things that really helps our community is that we have a community where people really are concerned about the problems and have relationships. We're a small enough community that we have relationships. And I think that's it's hard to fix things if you don't start there. I think the Haitians are good about that.
And I'm glad that you mentioned it, because just to bring it back to and when I said at the beginning, a lot of the classes that I take or the people that I work with are really focused on kind of the science of this or the policy of this, but we don't talk as much about religion, and I'll group it with culture, but really, like the influence of cult institution, is that okay? You know, at least in the work that I do, we don't really draw on, we don't talk a lot about that or analyze it quite as much. The power, I hate to use the word analyze and institution and all those when I refer to, because of the power of relationships and the power of, say this group of people who are concerned here and their ability to really reach out and connect, and then also within Haiti, those relationships, as you mentioned, how important those are. My big fear, I would just say personally, with, for example, climate change, we talked a little bit about this, is when more than one community is dealing with an extreme issue, when that ability to come to each other's aid isn't as easy in the future. I think that, personally, I think that might be a problem. Today I really hope to introduce to you, I have to apologize for all the big terms and models and things like that. I'm afraid I didn't break them down as well to you, but I did want to introduce to you the concept of resilience and really put in your minds, kind of take home that here's a term that is used by managers to think about communities and how to build communities up and how to analyze the problems of communities, and then actually to call on you to think about ways when you go back to your home communities. I'm sure you're already doing tons of stuff, but to access some of the resources that are out there to help build resilience. So that's my take home. And throughout the week, I'd like to talk about things like all the things that we talked about today, values and topic of tragedy of the commons, or how people use things up and don't necessarily give back. Communication, agencies, politics, that sort of thing. So it's just an opener. Hopefully there were questions in your mind today.
What's the difference? Earlier, on in your graph, you had the notion of resiliency and adaptability. What's the difference between resiliency and adaptability? Because I hear in some of these definitions you've given of resilience, many of them sound like definitions of adaptability I've read in other ecological literature. So what do you see as the distinctiveness between those
two? The difference between? I think resilience is ongoing and embodies adaptability, maybe. So resilience describes the system. I think adaptability describes the parts of the system. So if humans are adaptable in a system versus, say, Himalayan blackberry bushes that are invasive, those are really adaptable too. There's competition going on within the system, and I guess resilience would be the socio-ecological community, so human community, and say in this instance ecological community, and the ability of it to thrive and kind of go through the cycles. Whereas adaptability would be like one part of that system being able to thrive. That's how I see it. I'm not sure if that's different than what you've read.
And with that, at the other end of that, in that graphic description,
It
ultimately means transformability. According to that graph.
That seems like, according to this framework, that's the ideal, or that's kind of the end. Being able to, and they talk about different, another term on regime change, and so sometimes something will take over for a little while, like say after a forest fire, there will be like a regime change, or something will take over for a while, and then it'll shift back and back and forth, and so the system is actually transformed. I don't think we can say any of what's good or bad. I think this is all fluid. That's a hard part about this, I think, in a lot of ways. What are we going for here? I guess is a big question, and where do we fit? It's a term, resilience. It's a buzzword right now. We're taking the place of sustainability, I believe. So.
But it seems like how you define community is just as important, because you have a resilient community who lives on a river, has the resources when the flood comes to raise their seawalls and push the floods, upstream, downstream, in poor neighborhoods. And their community is resilient, but at the expense of the other communities.
The export, a different community is.
So that's bad.
Right. So, we can make judgment calls, of course, but we can't say this is all good or this is all bad. It has to be, think a little bit about it in parts. Yeah.
This is a terrible note to leave this on, but we talk about resilience. I mean, there was resilience on the Titanic. The band played on. They did the best they could with what they had to work with. But it didn't end the way we would want the Earth to end. So it's a big word, and it doesn't necessarily satisfy.
It's a big, perhaps made a mistake of starting with. It's a big concept to break down, but people say they want their communities to be resilient, and that it's not just a term that you throw out.
Is the definition of insanity making the same mistake over and over and over again?
and expecting a different result.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's the, but it's the actual expectation that defines insanity. And on that note.
Yeah. If you have other questions, I'm happy to talk to you one-on-one. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.